Hello everyone. It's a pleasure to introduce you to the tanker panel of the day. I'd like to say a special thanks to Niklas and the team for arranging this conference again here in Tokyo. It's the third year for us as partner, and it's a great platform that brings together financiers and companies and you know, discussing financing and shipping opportunities. So that's very exciting. And it's an honor to introduce the panelists today. To the right of you, Marco Fiori, the CEO of Premuda, a company with a very long heritage and proud heritage in the industry. Since taking the helm in 2019, Marco has led the company towards new heights. You own 26, as far as I can see, ships today, primarily on the product tanker side. And prior to joining Premuda, Marco was leading D'Amico for almost 23 years, bringing it over that period to a international industry leader in the product tanker space. So he has deep experience in managing and expanding shipping companies. So we look forward to learning a bit more during today's discussion. To left is Iraklis, the CFO of Okeanis Eco Tankers, which is listed on the New York Stock Exchange and Oslo Børs. It's currently having a market capitalization of $1.1 billion. The company is, you know, has earned a premium valuation in the market. It has 8 VLCCs and 6 Suezmaxes, and You know, Iraklis brings extensive experience in the maritime sector and certainly been vital for their success. Myself, Rika Wabo, is heading the investment banking division in Fearnley Securities, focusing on shipping and the energy sector. You know, I'm super excited to be here, and we have already had a lot of meetings with some of you in here today, and it's great to discuss opportunities and learn about your interest here. So let's, you know, we hope to bring some interesting opportunities to you. But before we start today, you know, just, you know, some very selective slides from the tanker space. If you can move to slide the next slide, it will be very short. We have already been through with an analyst today, so oh, is it me? Here we are. Perfect. If you look here, first on the demand side, ton-mile growth up 1.7%, still growing. The smaller segments are outperforming the bigger ones. It's interesting to see the long-term outlook and the difference between the demand and supply. Here we have the estimates from 24 to 2030. We see supplies of oil is coming up west of Suez. Demand is growing east of Suez. It creates geopolitical oil demand supply imbalance, which implied continued long-haul trade growth. Order book, 10.9%, larger on the smaller segments. Historically, it's a low level. If you think about a ship that lasts, you know, 20, 25 years, you know, this order book should probably be, 12, 15%, given that there's 3-year delivery. And it's lower than that. Coupled with this slide, which shows a bit about the age profile of the tanker fleet. As far as we can see, at the end of this year, 17% of the fleet, tanker fleet, is older than 20 years. Almost 40% is older than 15 years. And 2/3 of the ships are non-eco, with huge disadvantage on earnings. So far this year, a modern VLCC has eco in VLCC, have earned $8,500 per day in premium. That's $3 million a year, which is huge. Shipyards again are full until 2008, without going into details, geopolitical uncertainties are creating, affecting both the demand side and inefficiencies in the fleet on the supply side. If you look at tanker rates, they've been on left. It's the last 2-3 years less volatile than previously, but still at the moderate level. If you look on the right side, there is still a lot of optimism. In here we have 1 year TC rates on the product tankers, which is at the elevated level. But I guess, you know, by looking at this one, what does the capital market tell us about the future? And if you look at a period the last 10 years, we have seen VLCCs, new building and resales gone from, 100 down to, 80-ish, now up to $130 to $150 million. If you look on the line, the red line there, it's price to net asset value, which means that, above one, there should be super profit expected or continued increase in asset prices. When that occurs, it means that capital market are positive to the outlook, and certainly it's marked with green here. The outlook looks promising according to the capital market. So, with that as a backdrop, I think I run directly into a question or two to the panelists, and I start with you, Marco, and if we start on a very general basis on looking at the tanker market fundamentals. How do you view the market in the tankers today, and what do you look at when trying to follow where the demand and supply is going, and looking at the balance going forward? Can you give some color on that, Marco?
First of all, thank you very much for having me. It's always a pleasure to be here. I think that it's kind of a complicated question, because each segment has its own story of looking how it's going to develop. For sure, there is a lot of uncertainties, and I think volatility has been the main factor that's been helping tankers recently. I don't think that we're going to be lacking any volatility in the next years, because we're still going to have a lot of volatility. What I think is going to be interesting to see is just on the different segments how things are going to develop. I think it's important. I think Premuda is not a listed company, so we have we're less a little bit bound to being politically correct. We can a little bit tend to say things how they are. And in my opinion, the first thing that I would like to say, that in my personal opinion, which can be totally wrong, oil will be with us for a long time. So I think everybody who's going to tell you oil will go away, say yes, will probably phase down, but will be with us for a long time. I think the main question, I always say this when I talk to people, that if our the worldwide fleet was capable of scrapping all pre-eco ships and just moving into eco ship, I think that would be already a huge step forward in solving all the green problems that we have. But totally changing from oil to another supply of fuel, I think it's totally premature and it's very complicated. And then that depends very much from the size of the ship. Anyhow, going back to your question, what segments? I think that the trade of oil has, let's look at the geopolitical area. The trade of oil has been dramatically changing where it's coming and where it's going. I think in the past you could see, for example, the main supply of oil used in the United States was coming from the Persian Gulf. Today, I think between discoveries in the United States for fracking, I think that percentage has been slowing down. I wouldn't know the exact number, but for sure it's been slowing down. But instead, I think Hormuz and all that area has become very much vital for people like the Indians and the Chinese. So as, like I always say, I think it would not be unreasonable or unforeseeable one day to start seeing the Hormuz Strait patrolled by the military navy of China or India, because for them the safe transit of ships through Hormuz is much more relevant for them than it is for the Western world. We have suppliers in the United States, and then there is also Guyana is developing very quickly. There is the big question mark of Venezuela, but if something terrible happened, I'm sure the United States will find a way of removing all embargo to Venezuela just to get Venezuelan oil. So I think the Western world is pretty much protecting that. China and India still rely a lot on oil that's coming out through Hormuz. So I think for the big ships, I think it's important to see where they would be going and where it's coming. I'm not an expert on big ships. I can talk to you a little bit about product tankers. I've been doing this for the last 25, 26 years. And I think that the success, you know, we talk about, there was one of your slides, the smaller ships are doing much better than the big ships. I think that one of the reasons of the success of the smaller ships, and especially I'm talking about MR2s, when I started my life in D'Amico something like 25 years ago, I think probably there was 800 ships on the water. Today we're talking about 1,800 ships on the water. The main key success of all these ships has been the flexibility. MR2s has certainly been the... Imagine a little bit like the capillary vessels in the body. They take the blood from the big arteries and they spread it everywhere. MR2s have been mainly the supply of all the small ports everywhere. You know, they carry enormous quantity of products. I think an epoxy, phenolic epoxy coated MR2 can carry over 300 different products from caustic soda to human consumption products like vegetable oils, clean products, dirty products. So I think you should see it really as something that's been very flexible. And this flexibility has been enhanced by the factor that normally there is a return on a VLCC as kind of a one-way trip, then they rebalance to 1.0. On MRs, you can really see a lot of commercial considerations like triangulation. You can move with palm oil from Asia to Europe, from Europe to the United States. You can move with gasoline. Then you can move to South America, and then you can take vegetable oils and move them back to Asia, and then you start. On a VL, it's very difficult. Also, if lately there have been some VLs and Suezmax that have been used to carry big loads of refined products. But anyhow, it's kind of a fluke because there's only a few trips, but they don't have that kind of flexibility. So if you ask me what is my opinion, I think that if I had personally to order a ship today, probably I would keep it in the coated sector for the flexibility they have. I would certainly look at an eco ship with the most modern ways of saving of having an optimal speed and consumption, and especially I would be looking still at the oil, because I think especially for the segments of these smaller ships that, as I think, are very important for the supply of the world, it's kind of unimaginable thinking about converting all the logistics from what it is today into methanol or ammonia or whatever it is in every port that is touched by these ships. I think the bigger the ships, the more are subject, and they can be looked at this solution, LNG. But I think an MR with LNG would be very difficult to have, at least. This is my opinion.
Thank you for a very comprehensive answer. You just answered the first 10 questions here, so I'll... Over to you, Heraklis. You know, we saw on the slide at the end, it seems like there is optimism on especially on the larger crude segments, Suez and VLCCs, for 2025. Are there any risks we might oversee, or is this, should we just look at this as a blue sky scenario also for 25? What do you think?
Thank you also for having me. It's great to be part of this great company. I think you actually made the case for me with your slides. I actually believe it's the VLCC's time to shine. You know, obviously there are risks, but the VLCC's have been the least affected by all the tailwinds that have assisted some of the other subsegments of the industry. And I believe that this makes the case, this is probably the highest mitigating factor in terms of these risks. At the same time, you have you know, the strongest fundamentals, I believe, across the industry. Certainly within tankers, I could probably argue within most shipping segments today. Long-term demand fundamentals, I fully agree with Mark. Or, you know, oil is definitely here to stay. So for crude over the mid to long term, while growth may be a little slow, it's quite steady, and it's certainly multiplied by the effect of ton-mile. Catalyst may bring volatility in the short term. We see that today. But given our commercial and operational capabilities, we're actually able to capture quite a bit of value throughout periods of volatility. And then you have the supply side, which remains astonishing. You've shown the figures in terms of VLCC order book. They're the lowest within the tanker segment. And you have a situation with the yards where all the yards that are essentially capable of building large crude oil tankers, specialized modern equipment, they're busy every single day getting new orders on gas and new orders on container ships. So that, in parallel with the fact that we're past the days of you know, being able to go to Hyundai in Korea and order 8+8 VLCCs like this, because the yards just would rather keep the slots available for those other subsegments, and you could actually build those within 18 months, 20 months, 22 months, we are already talking about a slot availability. I'm not talking about one slot here and there, something that would actually move the needle materially well into 2028. And what's happening at the same time in parallel is you have a fleet that's generally very old, and every year that passes just continues to age further. You've shown some of the data. We see estimates that 30% of the VLCC fleet by 2028, which is anywhere before we can see order book move materially, is going to be we're going to have 30% of VLCCs being 20 years and older. So the need for replacement by the industry is actually going to be very, very substantial, well above current order book, and potentially, you know, even an increased order book because of that. So I am optimistic about VLCCs. Having said that, I believe that when we do see those higher rates within our particular subsegment, that's actually going to benefit the rest of the tanker segment as well, because I expect that there is going to be a trickling down effect towards the other segments too.
No, I agree with what Iraklis was saying. You know, I made this case many times. You know, fortunately, unfortunately, I participate to a lot of these events. And I remember a few years ago saying, I'm going back to the quoted side of the fleet, that the number of yards that we're building quoted tankers has been shrinking dramatically. And this also on the tankers in general. You know, in Japan, you had a lot of yards. Today, probably have 2 yards that still build quoted tankers, you know. And probably today also those 2 yards would prefer build something different because there is higher margins, easier to build. So in a scenario where number of ships delivered is going down, the number of yards also delivering a certain type of ships is decreasing faster than that. And I think this applies to all of the tankers, because at the end of the day, if you look on a scale, when you start building a tanker, it is kind of a complicated thing. You know, all the blocks, all the pipes have to match, but putting those blocks together, it's kind of a complicated job. Then this is in general. Then I think on the VLs, I think it's, I've never managed VL, but I think it's a great segment. Totally has its dynamics. It's not a ship you can trade around or triangulate, but has some very interesting dynamics because it goes from one part of the world to the opposite. We are more the guys that distribute these products that are carried into the main ports of the VLs. But for sure, there is a very strong case to be made about. We had some Suezmaxes. Big ships are certainly very, very attractive. but especially for the fact that order book is not enormous. I start seeing a little bit with a little bit of pain and anguish that product tankers is 12% order book. It starts being a good number. And so that's one thing. Another argument that Heraclius was touching, and this I tell you about argument about experience. As you know, the tanker segment is also very regulated by vetting, oil majors, traders, age, ship, and everything. But by miracle, and I don't know how that happens, by miracle, when you are in a good market and ships become scarcer, you know, the vetting issues become much easier, the acceptance of older ships becomes much easier. So, you know, all of a sudden, everybody accepts anything, you know. And instead, when the market sucks, everybody's very picky about the ship. No, let's go to the next, fail. So I think, you know, it's a kind of an equation which you can't stretch things continuously. I think average age of ships, normally the cut line was for TC business, was 15 years for major customers and oil majors. But I think they'll have to stretch that age a little bit, you know, because the dark fleet has taken all the older ships. Those who remained are getting a little bit older. So I think what's going to happen is that people have to adapt. And we hear more and more that older ships are getting accepted because there's no other way of doing it. You know, it's not impossible to do.
One question that got that I thought about. I discussed recently with some Chinese friends who are mentioned that they are seeing a lot after the real estate crash, more or less in China. A lot of these workers, engineers, are going back to the shipyard industry. Could we see a We've talked about the shipyard capacity coming down dramatically, etc. But could we see now a new wave of workforce and yard capacity being, call it, reactivated or built in China, do you think, Marco?
Look, I understand your question, and I've been posing the same question. China has certainly an excess of workers in the real estate industry, and they've been moving some to the shipping. But strangely enough, I don't know if anybody remembers 2006, 7, 8, there was this great word was established in those days, greenfield yards. This time you don't see many greenfield yards coming. What you see is some of those greenfield yards building blocks for the major shipyards, and then the major ships are pretty together. But you don't see a lot of these new yards coming through also because, you know, old dogs can learn new tricks, but at least they remember that last time they did it, they've all been taken to the cleaners. So, you know, so I think that was the lesson that was taken in general. So I think China is very reluctant. But your question, I think it is very important for something that I probably discussed here or in Singapore. And I think I would love to have some kind of response from the audience. If you look historically, the shipping industry, you know, started from Europe, then moved to the United States, then moved to Japan, then moved to Korea, and now is mainly in China. But normally all these places have been bypassed by the newcomers that could offer a cheaper labor force and a large labor force. So the question that I'm asking myself, and that's why I'm asking also for your help to shape a little bit my thinking, who's going to be the next country after China? You know, we can't restart after going back to Europe because that can't happen. India, Vietnam, but also, you know, all these countries have some limitations. But I think there's always been a next country. And so today we should ask ourselves, what's going to be after China? Because shipping, it is vital for the world economy. And, you know, we can say whatever we want, but, you know, I think everything we touch in our life at one point or another has been on board of a ship. So, you know, we can't imagine the world without shipping and without transportation, cheap transportation and shipping. So my question is, who's going to be after China? Because that's going to be a question that one day the world, today we have the people from the real estate moving in there, but one day, you know, working in a yard, you talk to a lot of Japanese yards, some of them are here, life in a yard is really tough, you know. It's dangerous, it's tough. The climate is can be hot in the summer, brutally cold in winter. It's not against us. So if you give a young person the opportunity, you know, go and work in an office or go and work in a shipyard, I think most of the people would choose to go and work in an office and not in a shipyard. So I think this is the question that we should really ask ourselves, because that's who thinks about this will be way ahead on in the future. What do you think, Iraklis?
Which is the next country?
As time runs, you know, I think we'll drop the question, you know, where you do that afterwards.
It was your question.
But, you know, we don't unfortunately have time to ask the audience. Let's run to the next one in terms of growth strategy. And you, Iraklis, has been completing a successful IPO, holding your promises, being the response from the capital market is to price you well above analysts' estimates on net asset value. What's the next step now for you?
Yeah, we have been quite focused in terms of your own throughout the years on delivering on what we promised. This in combination with our competitive advantages, our fleet. I'm not an expert in big ships either, but our commercial team is doing a good job in terms of our
other experts in small ones. I just look like it, but don't worry.
So our fleet, our commercial performance, governance, and dividend track record, allowed us to establish a track record of trust with investors, which is reflected on how they view us as an investment opportunity and essentially. Within pricing, obviously, when you trade at a premium, there are opportunities that can add value to your shareholders. We have been highly focused on improving our trading liquidity. We think this step will further unlock, increase pricing capacity in the context of overall tanker pricing valuation. Even without a catalyst, since our dual listing in New York, we have managed to double our dollar trading liquidity compared to last year on a daily basis. And already year to date, over half of our trading volume is actually done out of New York, which is indicative of the very promising signs that we see out of our U.S.-based investor base for when the opportunity arises. But we have been and will continue to be patient and disciplined. So our key priority remains one, just keep delivering on exactly what we promised, and everything else will just fall into place.
Thank you. Marco, when thinking about growth, where's your key focus right now? Are new buildings part of your growth strategy going forward? And any particular, you've already mentioned it and touched upon it, okay. Any particular views on the future fuel?
Well, the fuel already told you.
Yeah.
I'll keep in mind you didn't want to answer which is going to be the next country, but that we'll talk about it later on. The fuel, I think it's going to be oil for a while, especially depending on segments of ship. I think putting alternative fuels on a handy dry cargo ship that trades everywhere in the world, I think, would be a very complicated proposition. For us, the growth, I come from a company, the previous home I had in D'Amico was mainly a pre-oil product tanker fleet, a pre-oil product tanker company. Within the group, we had also a big dry cargo segment. I think that unless you are very focused on your segment, and I think there has been some changes on this, at least from my last conversation with capital markets, there start to be a sentiment also in capital markets that a balanced company where there is some tankers and some dry seems to be gaining some traction, because people start seeing a little bit the benefit of one offsetting the other one. There is a counter cyclicality between the two, but anyhow, this is what I think. I think today tankers are very expensive to purchase. Dry cargo is also very expensive, but between the two, I would probably look at the renewable fleet, renewing the fleet more in the dry cargo segment than in the tanker segment. I think there is more opportunity in dry cargo. Then what segments in dry cargo? Probably I would be looking at Handys and Ultras, not because I know much about them, but I think geopolitically going there, if you see some kind of resolution of the Ukrainian war, you have a country that has to be rebuilt. You have enormous amount of funds that have been allocated to that rebuilding. So I think that having the right fleet to participate in this rebuilding effort would be one of the winning key efforts, if you have to think a little bit forward. But, you know, that would be my basis. So dry, probably more than tankers, and the smaller segments, Ultra and Handys.
Thanks. Okay, so are you considering growth on any... You know, you have somewhat limited mandate on VLs and Suezmaxes. Are there any opportunities for growth there, as you see it?
Yeah, I mean, you're correct. The scope is narrow, but that has been our advantage. You know, first of all, we don't need to grow. We're perfectly happy with the size of our fleet. It gives us the flexibility and agility in terms of our commercial performance. And we actually look at Okeanis as a project, which just has one priority: maximize shareholder value. So, by the way, I'm not saying this is a likely scenario, but if the circumstances direct us towards that way, I could very well see also a scenario that we reduce in size. But, you know, I understand your point. We're listed, we're dual listed, we pay all these costs for that. And as you rightly pointed out before, our pricing gives us the opportunity and the flexibility to identify opportunities that we could potentially use the stock as currency, and we're always on the lookout for something like that. Now, for secondhand vessels, asset values are not optimum today, but if we did identify the right opportunity that does fit our scope, our narrow scope within Okeanis, and we could structure it the right way. So number one, make it accretive to shareholders. And number two, not jeopardize the dividend capacity. Then we would definitely consider it. Now, new buildings, given the strategic direction of Okeanis and the fact that we try to pay out all the cash flows that we get and all the value that we create immediately to shareholders, due to the delayed cash flows and long lead delivery times of new buildings, these are likely excluded from the potential options that we see today. Now, that's my response with regards to Okeanis, the public platform of the sponsor. Now, having said that, you know, we have been working really hard all of these years to establish a brand name within the capital markets. There is ammunition that is being built through the healthy, cash flows that we're enjoying on the tanker side, and other opportunities that we could pursue in the future, combined with a track record in capital markets, is something that we could look at. But within Okeanis, the scope is very, very narrow and very, very specific.
You know, there are several financing institutions in the audience today, and you know, over to the financing part. In June, you announced the refinancing of a Suezmax at SOFA plus 160 basis points, which is quite impressive. Over the year, last year, you have refinanced basically the whole fleet. You know, can you give a bit of color of how you went, how that process has been, and what is your key parameters when you look for financing today?
Sure. It has been a good process. So, yes, as you rightly pointed out, other than a couple of legacy leases whose purchase options do not kick in until the early part of 2026, we essentially refinanced the entire rest of our fleet, so 12 out of our 14 vessels. We utilized the momentum achieved by the earlier financings we did back in the summer and fall of 2023, and then each and every new transaction that we made was actually better than the previous one. So we achieved three things. One was we extended maturities. Again, other than the purchase options in 26, All the rest of our maturities are staggered between 2028 and 2031. We have added flexibility, and we have improved pricing significantly. You know, especially comparing to the pre-SOFR transition era, we have improved pricing on all the refinanced vessels by 130 basis points. That's an improvement on break-even of $1,700 per day, $7.5 million in 1 year. That's a very, very significant number for a company of our size. Furthermore, we've been particularly happy with the fact that we have been developing our relationships and extending new, and getting granted new loans by Asian financiers. It's been a strategic direction that we have consciously made to invest more into sourcing further financing from Asia, in parallel to the relationships that have lasted decades in Europe. Now, having gone through the exercise of the recent refinancings, and other than the purchase option in 2026, we're pretty much done as of today. But we're having interesting meetings. If we find something accretive, we could jump on it.
What would be of interest then? You know, what would they need to offer?
we've set a good benchmark with the last one. Yeah. We've actually done one at 142.
Wow. Marco, as a private company, how do you approach financing compared to public companies like Okeanis? And are there any challenges or advantages specific to your structure? And last, when are you going to be listed?
This is a question for Nicolas. Look, I think heading a public and a non-public company, and before a non-public, so was non-public, public, non-public. That was my life. I think they're very similar. I think it comes down to few things, but these are important things in life, not only in financing. Create yourself a great reputation. Surround yourself with good friends, wherever they are, and I always love to come to Japan because I feel I have a lot of friends and it's a fantastic country for discussing business. And then try to do your best and keep your promises. I think if you keep, and so there's nothing financial what I'm saying, but if you keep these few parameters in check in life, I think you'll always be very good, look, because at the end of the day, you're not judged. I think it's important I talk to my CFO, I talk to previous CFOs, where the 3 basis points is, we got 2 basis points. I think what is 2 basis points in the long term of a relationship? It's nothing. But it's not better to pay off 2 basis points more, but making sure that that bank that is there is happier. And next time you have to be doing a deal, they'll be there sitting at the table. You know, for me, I think I'm looking at things a little bit more on an open thing, because if you do a transaction just for saving 5 basis points, there's the reason of doing the transaction, probably you're better off not even doing it, you know. So I think in life, I think long-term relationship, and this is a good part of our shipping, then normally you keep a relationship and people still have memory in shipping. So that's a good thing.
Yeah. I fully agree with the point. Maybe on new business, the public element assists in establishing a new relationship, given the transparency of having all the data available. Sometimes for new business,
can help.
It can assist.
But you would agree in the long term?
Absolutely.
Thoughtful answer. Thank you for that. At Fernlis, our analysts believe in $60,000 a day for VLCCs next year. Heracles, over or under? What's your expectation?
Well, let me answer it this way. We are positive on the market fundamentals with, as we have discussed earlier, in the supply situation and the current balance that we see is done in such a way when, once we do see a catalyst, I think there's going to be a multiplier effect on rates. But for us, we're in this great position that we can source further value on top of spot markets. So we don't just need, you know, a full specific quarter to be at high rates, because we are able to take advantage of a little bit of the volatility and the spikes. So, you know, if rates do average 60,000 a day, I could, you know, I'm confident that many of our vessels could actually achieve the 80 and the 90 and the 100,000 spikes that will inevitably come.
Okay, so you are more positive. we're getting close to the final question, and I'm sure there's more than me that wants Marco's answer. But what country then would be the next shipbuilding nation, Marco?
I don't have a clue. That's why I'm asking. You know, I think probably India, Vietnam. Vietnam has limited capacity. India is very complicated. All the regulatory environment, but really don't have a clue, I think. And the world could be in a very tough situation. If it stops to China, inevitably China cost will go higher, and then the world will having a problem of building the number of ship it needs at the price it wants. You know, so I think then about that, I don't have a clue. So if that's the story, it probably is very good for people buying ships at whatever price today.
We covered the tanker market. We covered it on rates, growth strategy, financing. Marco and Iraklis, thank you very much
thank you.
For
thank
the
you.
Panel discussion. Thank you.